Gatha of Atonement. All evil karma ever created by me, since of old, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought, now I atone for it all. So I thought that this evening I would explore one of these beginningless aspects of karma, our ignorance. I think greed is kind of easy to understand, our way of longing and grasping desire, and how we can become selfish out of that. Anger, sometimes also described as aversion, is also something that acted on, can kind of clearly cause harm. But ignorance can be a little bit less clear in terms of this reading. What does that really mean? I mean, if we're ignorant of something, if I don't know, what 5 times 3 is, and I can't figure it out, am I supposed to know everything? Is that what this is saying? What is this ignorance that they're talking about? So I thought it was worth exploring that, because maybe that's a little bit confusing. I've heard it described in our tradition, sometimes we describe ignorance as certainty, delusive certainty, which I think is very interesting. That would be the idea that we take our thoughts about reality and we believe them to be, the absolute truth. We believe that what we think is really the way things are. And our Dharma suggests that things are never the way we think they are. Not even like they sometimes aren't. They are never exactly the way we think they are, because our thoughts are these very superficial symbolic representations of reality, and reality is obviously so much more complicated. So my ideas about a person can just be, surface. They can only be sort of skin deep. Even if I write a whole novel about a person, I'm only capturing those moments, and even those moments I'm not actually capturing. You could write 1,000 pages about this room and still not capture every detail. So this idea that our thoughts are incapable of actually capturing reality. And this, of course, brings about a different way of relating with our thinking, a little bit more of a kind of humble sense of what our thoughts can actually do. But ignorance isn't limited to that kind of form. We also describe ignorance as ignorance of the Dharma, ignorance of the teachings themselves, which are liberative, that help alleviate suffering. And there's this possibility of exploring the teachings. And at the heart of this is the fundamental Dharma, that emptiness is exactly form, that there is no abiding innate selfhood anywhere. This is the heart of the Dharma that the Buddha taught, one of the very few teachings on which the Buddha was uncompromising, if you will. Sure, he would say there's a relative story, a relative truth we tell about the self, that we exist in a relative sense, and we can describe ourselves in relation, and as such there are senses of self that are born out of that, but that they are always ever-changing, mutable, not fixed in any way. This is quite a counter-cultural thing for him to suggest at the time when people were searching for the Atman. They were searching for the innate spiritual everlasting Brahman inside themselves, this divine essence or spark that was believed to exist in the Hindu teachings, in the Vedas, and so this was quite a countercultural notion, and I would suggest it's a countercultural notion here, too, We have the idea of independent selves. And of course, we are independent in certain ways. So in those relative senses, you know, I am not you, you are not me. We each have different names. But that doesn't mean that there is some innate referent that never changes, that is inside me, that that name is pointing to. There's no way that, there's no point in trying to argue this. It's not a philosophical point, really, so much as something to see for ourselves. If you are someone who believes that you do have an innate, unchanging self, then I think probably the Buddha would say, you know, show me. and that would be very difficult. We would have a difficult time doing that. It's always kind of fun to read Descartes trying to talk about his innate unchanging self, and you know, the best he can do is say that it's a thing that thinks, a thing that does all these things. Where there's a verb, there must be a subject. So based on this grammatical principle, there must be a self. So it's fascinating. You know, of course, people will debate all this in philosophy, but our practice is to look, is to really look for ourselves, to shine the light within and see for ourselves what we actually are. This is our practice, and we are invited into it with this promise that as we realize what we actually are, that self-clinging will be reduced, that our self-centered approach to life, that this way that we place ourselves in the center of everything all the time and prioritize our own well-being over the well-being of others will be reduced. Now, perhaps it can never be entirely eliminated, but we vow endlessly, don't we, to save all beings, to see through our delusions. Delusions are endless. I vow to end them. This being the great granddaddy of all delusions, this notion of an innate self that we are always protecting. There was a really nice article recently in Psych, which is this kind of cool little digital reader that comes out every newsletter type thing that comes out on Fridays. And there's a woman who wrote, I can't remember her name, sorry, Emily something, I think. Actually a philosophy professor who was writing about ignorance. And she described how she had always felt like quite a competent intellectual, you know, being a professor. Then got COVID and had this brain fog that beset her for months and months and months, and basically like couldn't keep track of her car keys, couldn't write, you know, would go looking in rooms for what she was looking for and forget what it was she was looking for, and on it went. And just really, really having a very difficult time functioning, but could not accept this about her circumstances because she was very attached to the idea that she was an innately competent person, and so this made her suffer many, many times more. We talk about an arrow landing in one place and then a second arrow. This was the second arrow, the piercing in the same place. So the athlete gets older, suffers some kind of injury, can no longer do that thing anymore. And that's the loss, but then on top of it is the loss of that sense of self, or the clinging to that sense of self that actually causes greater suffering when circumstances inevitably change. So as we change, we can find it very difficult to go with the flow. And it's understandable, right? This is how it is. We have senses of self. But it is the clinging to these senses of self. It is the centering of them. It is the acting on their behalf, which is what exacerbates our suffering. When we are trying to get ourselves into roles and things and imagining that the identity that accompanies it will be completely satisfying because it will finally be me attaining the me that I really am. And of course, it never plays out that way. We just have ever-changing senses of self. We don't get to this fixed place where we have attained the self that we were always meant to be. This is very disappointing. This is not, welcome to the Dharma. The Dharma is, I always feel like such a jerk whenever I give a talk because, you know, talks are always like, here, let me let a little more air out of your balloon. The Buddha was doing this as medicine, right? These are the things that actually cause us to suffer. This self-clinging is the source, the primary source of our suffering, the Buddha argued. And we're ignorant of that, so we just keep doing it. We just, this is samsara, we just keep getting on that hamster wheel. We keep chasing after the next better sense or self. It's very painful. Did you come here to fix yourself? Did you join a sangha to become a better self? So I wanted to also explore the reading that we did today called Fear. Yes, these relate. See fear, just say yes, and see what happens. When we do this, another world opens up where energy fills the belly and calms the mind. The eye steps aside. Something begins to enjoy engaging the process. Fearlessness is not the absence of fear, but the willingness to walk into it. When I walk into my fear, practice there, sit upright in the middle of it, completely open to the experience with no expectation of the outcome, anything is possible. When our circumstances look impossible or terrifying, there is a way. It may look like the way is even more impossible than the circumstances, but if we step into it with eyes and heart open, take one step off the 100-foot pole, something will be revealed. What is that step off the 100-foot pole? It isn't what we necessarily expect. We so often imagine that we can fix ourselves. Oh, I see. So I'm not supposed to be focused on senses of self, on fixing them, right? So, but it is hard to simply, this wheel is in motion, right? This is a way that our culture has conditioned us, and we use this word I so often, imagining that we know just what it means. But then when we look into it, we find it's quite a mystery. There are many things where we feel this kind of aversion. Things that we don't like. To think about these other words within our chant. Aversion, anger. These aspects of life that we don't like. And so we imagine that we can just not be them. When fear arises, I can just go around it. I will just go a different direction. I will repress it, or I will fix it. That's our tendency. I will enact it. when I have a longing to be a different self, to have a different sense of myself, I will aim outside of myself to become that different self in some way. Do you see how these relate? This sense of self has arisen in me. I don't like it. I'm going to do something to be something different. I'm unsatisfied with myself as I am. So I will do something to fix my sense of self. What's at root there is an investment in that self. We imagine that that sense of self is pointing to something real, that it has a fixed referent, that it has something that underlying it that can be fixed. So the invitation is to try looking, try just paying attention, just look into it. What is it? What is this fear that I'm feeling? What is this sense of inadequacy that I feel that drives me to do things to compensate for that over and over again? What is it? What is it actually pointing toward? What is this fear? Not, you know, what is this fear that I'm feeling? Where does it live inside me? Where does this sense of self live inside me? So we invite a very bodily practice, right? This possibility that when we see this fear, when we see this sense of inadequacy, when we see this pride, spiritual pride, I'm so great, I get it all. What if we, rather than trying to either argue with it or fix it, we just see it? Say yes, oh yes, here it is. Here is my inadequacy, here is my pride, here is my fear. And don't do anything. Just see it and see what happens. When we do this, a world opens up where energy fills the belly and calms the mind. The eye steps aside. The eye steps aside. What an interesting way of putting it. Another way of putting it is that maybe we don't find anything with any kind of fixed essence there at all. We just find energy. We just find movement. We find this churning in the belly. We find thoughts arising and passing. We just find sensations like clouds floating across the sky. There is something enjoyable about this. It's quite ironic to turn towards something that we think of as so awful and unendurable, this sense of inadequacy, perhaps, that drives us to do more and more things, that we run from endlessly. What a thing to just stop running, to just be just as we are. It won't destroy you. Something begins to enjoy this process of seeing the energy shape-shifting. Because we're beginning to see that there isn't anything actually there at all. That whole notion, the only thing to fear is fear itself. not even. What is fear? What is it? Fearlessness is not the absence of fear, but the willingness to walk into it, to be it, to let ourselves be embodied, to allow the energy to arise, to allow the story to arise and just pass, to let it just do its little dance. I sometimes talk about these intense emotional states as like firework shows, because they aren't inherently like good or bad. We label them good or bad, but they're really just like these intense firework shows that go off in your mind and in your body. And if we can learn to just be with them and endure them and not act on them, we find that there's nothing that we had to run from in the first place, nothing that we needed to run toward, that everything we are, that everything that we seek, we already are. You know, we just cannot believe that. We just cannot believe it. We say, dude, you are so full of crap. I am here because I am defective, because I have a serious problem. I have to go out and do other stuff because my life is so bad. You know, one of the fears that I've been sitting with lately is the election. This is the first time I have brought this up in our Sangha. I'm just sitting with this impending who knows what, the not knowing. Every so often I'll go check out what the polls say and freak myself out. Check out what the betting odds are. Oh, find the anxiety rising in myself. And that can be difficult, you know. And of course, there are things that we can do to engage this process. You know, I encourage everyone to look into the precepts, think about who it is that you feel most embodies them. Support that person. Maybe we can each do what we can. And there is something about taking a small step, even if it's just a drop of water in a bucket, if you will. But that still really does help with the feeling, right? You're contributing in some meaningful way. I encourage it. You know, but the fear still arises, the concern, the anxiety. So we also have this, you know, and we're not going to be super skillful in anything we do if we're just driven by fear, you know. So we also have this beautiful practice of just letting the fear blossom in us. Just let it show up. Be with it. Give it space to unfold without having to run away from it. Because this is where we really get the deepest insight. You know, if we're always fixing things exclusively, you know, if we're exclusively fixing things outwardly in some way, we never have the opportunity to really do introspection and look inward to see what's happening inside of ourselves that is driving us crazy, that's making us go, 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 go. What's the engine underlying all that? We need to see that. We need to see very clearly what the engine is. It's very, very important. We can't only act outwardly and fix everything outwardly. There's just too much to fix, folks, about ourselves and about the world. This practice invites another kind of healing, a kind of healing where we look very deeply into these constellations of fear, of deficiency, of desire, of anger. And we don't have to fix them. We can become more choiceful about it. We can, of course, take action, and there are times to, but the point here is that there's something deeper that is also encouraged in this practice, this very deep possibility of healing, of seeing that things are not the way that we think they are, to go back to that root issue of ignorance. We have these amazing containers that allow this to happen. The containers of stillness, of silence. And all we really need to do is keep throwing ourselves into these containers again and again. And when we feel these impulses arising in us, instead of rushing out and taking action, maybe try just sitting first for a bit. Or for a year, or for 10 years. Thank you.